be handling in this consolidated appeal arguments 1, which is the search warrant issue, 2 and 4, or 3 and 4, which deal with the sufficiency of the evidence arguments, argument 6, which pertains to the Bruton issue, and then 2 arguments number 9 and 10 dealing with DeCardio Glisson's sentencing issues. My colleague, Mr. Sneed, who represents Derek Glisson, will be handling the remaining arguments. Your Honor, the facts of this case are amply laid out in the briefs in this case, or the briefs. Initially, we look at the search warrant issue, Franks v. Delaware, and look at the challenge pretrial and the judge's ultimately denial of our motion to suppress the evidence, the fruits of that, which were seized on June 14, 2007 from the truck at the Timmy Hospital parking lot.
If I could ask you, Mr. Milling, I'm happy to hear your argument, but why isn't this a perfectly acceptable automobile search?
Why isn't it?
Yes.
Because if we look at what the government propounds as being probable cause in this case, if we look at what the facts are which are announced in the affidavit, even as we redact the clearly false statement.
No, yes. I'm not talking about the warrant.
Yes, sir.
Victim of a shooting pulls up in a car outside the emergency room of a hospital.
Yes, sir.
He's in the hospital. The officers show up. There's blood in plain view. There's blood in the car. There's shell casings outside the car.
Yes, sir.
Is it your argument, and I'm not sure why the government didn't pursue this, and they were entitled to pursue it or not, but the way I see this, those officers could have gone into that car immediately.
Well,
what am I missing here?
Well, with all due respect, I don't think that they could have gotten into the vehicle at that point in time.
Why not?
Well, because I don't think there was the probable cause existed or any other warrant exception to demonstrate that that vehicle contained evidence of a crime or that the occupants of that vehicle participated in any type of a crime, simply because the vehicle transported a victim of a crime to the hospital, I don't think gives...
What about the shell casings that were outside the vehicle?
Well, I think that certainly that is something that the court looked at. I think that's something that law enforcement clearly considered in determining whether or not they wanted to ultimately gain entry into the vehicle. But I think if we look at whether or not
wasn't it a crime scene?
Well, I would submit that it's not a crime scene.
Why
I think
is it not? Well, do you dispute that they saw blood?
No, sir, Your Honor. The testimony was very clear that they saw blood and they found the shell casings outside of the vehicle.
How could it not be a crime scene?
Well, I guess my understanding and definition of a crime scene is where the crime actually took place, where the shooting in this situation took place.
And there was blood in the car.
Well, there was blood in the car, which I would submit demonstrates that the vehicle transported the victim, Mr. Derek Glisson, to the hospital. I don't think that the evidence necessarily demonstrates that the vehicle was actually the crime scene. I think that's
okay.
How.
I don't want you to consume your time. If you want to talk about the warrant, of course.
Yes, sir. And I will briefly.
I'm having a hard time understanding why this isn't almost a classic automobile search for which there was probable cause. Not that your client or the occupants were necessarily. Not that there was probable cause that they committed a crime, but that there was probable cause to believe that contraband and or evidence of criminal activity would be found in the vehicle.
And, Your Honor, I would just submit that when we're looking at the Fourth Amendment and the warrant requirement, and what you're talking about, I would submit is an exception to the warrant requirement, Your Honor. But if we're looking at that, the warrant requirement, I would submit, requires some type of specificity as to what the crime is, and it's not against the law to be shot or to shoot somebody. Accidents happen. It really does, Your Honor. But Your Honor, I would just submit that looking at the warrant in this case, it was deficient. It was clear. You excise all of the other false statements.
Why is it as a warrant, beyond the question, good question about the automobile search?
Yes, sir.
And you said transported somebody, but just for what it's worth, the officers that arrived, they don't know that it's been used to transport anybody. I mean, from any scene, it could have happened right there. They don't know about anything about transportation. But if we look at your argument about the warrant, go there. Why is it insufficient on the redacted search warrant?
Because I don't think law enforcement points to a specific crime that they allege had been committed, that's shooting on St. Paul Church.
I didn't ask you that. I know that.
Yes, sir.
You just want to say because that's in it. Okay.
Yes, sir. That is part of what drives the affidavit to the magistrate, what drives to them leading that this vehicle was actually participating in that crime. And I don't think that there's any other evidence to suggest, once we've removed all the other...
Well, I don't know about that. What about that? What about the piggybacking sort of the automobile search? What you have in there, you have that information. I don't know if that's particularly relevant or not, but what you do have in the search warrant, I don't have it in front of me now, but I think I know what it says, that there was a vehicle with bloodstains in the vehicle, shells visible in the car, on the ground next to it.
Right.
Why isn't that enough without anything else?
Well, because we're in Sumter County, South Carolina, where people use guns all the time for legal purposes, for hunting purposes. This was during hunt. It was during the summer months, but it's still lawful for people to carry, to use guns. And again, accidents do happen. There have been no distress call to 911 suggesting that the occupants were arriving, having been victims, if you will, as opposed to anything other than
that. There was a gunshot wound to the hand, if we know it at that point.
Yes, sir.
But you don't think that makes enough for a search warrant? Not that a crime necessarily occurred, but probable cause to believe that a crime occurred.
Well, I would submit that I don't think that in itself is sufficient to demonstrate the probable cause that a crime had been committed, or that more probably than not, this vehicle contained evidence of that crime.
Ah, see, that was a major misstep. You know full well that the standard is not more probable than not.
Yes, sir.
I mean, you know that, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
It's a fair probability.
Yes, sir.
The fair probability that the evidence of criminal activity would be found in this car.
Yes, sir.
And they already found evidence just outside the car.
Well, they found evidence that a gun had been shot, the shell case.
Well, several shots.
Yes, sir.
Not just the gun shot.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Again, I didn't mean to consume all your time on the question of search warrant. You had one or two other issues you wanted to...
Yes, sir. We've got other issues dealing with the sufficiency of the evidence, and I would just submit we've outlined very clearly in our brief where we don't think that there was sufficient evidence to establish, number one, that DeCardio Glisson, my client, possessed the vehicle when it arrived at the hospital. Interestingly enough, we've got standing to challenge the search warrant based upon statements which were not admitted to the jury, but we've got no evidence which links my client to the vehicle when it arrives at the parking lot. And so, as we argued in our brief, there was insufficient evidence to establish that my client possessed the guns or the drugs which were found in the vehicle. Moving on to the conspiracy count, there's likewise insufficient evidence to establish that my client and his brother in any way conspired to engage in drugs.
What about Bramlett?
Bramlett says that he never dealt with my client. He never saw my client deal drugs. The only thing Bramlett says is that he has seen DeCardio and Derek in the presence of drugs together. But he also says that he's seen Derek sell drugs.
And they were in the car together just before the transport to the... Okay.
Yes, sir. And if I may just move very quickly on to the Bruton issue, and I would submit that the Bruton line of cases and the Crawford line of cases most recently in Melendez-Diaz are not mutually exclusive tracks of cases. Looking at the redactation here of Derek Glisson's statement, it is very clear that he's talking about the driver. The driver being the same person who was the driver of the vehicle at the time of the shooting and the driver of the vehicle at the time that it arrived at the Toomey Hospital, and that is the ultimate issue here as to whether or not my client was in possession of the vehicle. So it's clearly not a harmless error. I submitted the Mayfield case, and I see that I'm out of time. If I could just briefly wrap up this.
You may.
The Mayfield case, which I submitted earlier this week, is a case out of the Ninth Circuit, which clearly authorizes the use of other evidence which had been previously introduced during the trial to demonstrate that the statement on its face or by inference was incriminating. So thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Mr. Sneed.
Court, Your Honors. Your Honor, I'm from represent Mr. Derek Glisson. First argument this is argument two regarding 922G charge. He's a prior CDB misdemeanant. Excuse me. I'm assuming that this court, I'm sure, is familiar with the case law post Heller course, Heller set with the seminal case. Then we had McDonald a few years later apply it to the states. Ultimately, our position on 922G is that this court should remand, direct the district court to apply intermediate scrutiny to see if the government can meet its burden under intermediate scrutiny. The two leading cases are from this court are Chester, and if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Mascandaro, and those were different panels. I know, Judge, that you were in the concurrence on Chester.
Both of those were in-home possession, correct?
No, sir.
Mascandaro, I can't pronounce it either. Chester was in-home possession.
Yes, sir.
What was the other one?
Mascandaro was on a national park.
National park, right.
So if I hopefully I'm stating this accurately, if reading Chester and Mascandaro is if you have a person, no convictions, they're in their home, that's the most core Second Amendment right, most fundamental.
And this case is about as far from that as you can get.
I respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor.
We have a gun in a home in this case?
No, sir.
Okay.
Because we have a gun in Sumter County?
No, sir. The reason I say it is if Chester says it's a CDV misdemeanor, he's in the home, we're going to apply intermediate scrutiny. All right? Then on Mascandaro, the person has a loaded gun in their car on the national park or in a national park. The court says you go outside the home, it's not going to be strict scrutiny. But here the court gave intermediate scrutiny. I respectfully suggest intermediate scrutiny here, and here's why. The government...
I'm sorry, did we affirm in the second case?
Yes, sir. Chester...
Chester sent it back.
Yes, sir.
But the National Park case affirmed the conviction.
Right. The National Park case, if I'm reading Chester correctly, this court remanded in Chester and said we want the district court in the first instance to do the intermediate scrutiny analysis, have the government meet its burden. We're not going to do it. In Mascandaro, the one in the national park, the court didn't remand, and it did its own intermediate scrutiny analysis and found that the government met its burden. That's the difference on those. Here, the reason I respectfully suggest intermediate scrutiny is appropriate is, as far as the use of the weapon here, the only evidence that the government presented was it was used in self-defense. So the government presented the evidence of a Mr. Bramlett. And Mr. Bramlett's testimony, again, a government witness, is that the weapon was used in self-defense.
And that's the essence of the Second Amendment right.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. So we're not going to make a facial challenge, an overbreath challenge. I've read the court's two.
The question is, do you have some argument about who should do the, which court should do the intermediate?
I would respectfully suggest...
I know what you suggest. Yes, I'm asking why you say that in light of those other two cases. I think that's what Judge Davis was asking you.
Yes, sir. In Chester, I think the court wanted the district court to engage in that fact-finding.
Apparently so. They remanded it.
Yes, sir. In Mascandaro, as I read the case, it appears that there were facts developed below at the trial such that the court did not, the Fourth Circuit, when it came up here, did not see a need to remand. That's how I see the difference. And the other one is, in Mascandaro, the court cited, apparently made references to evidence that justified the National Park regulation at issue. Here you don't have that, because if you look at the evidence, you have a CDV misdemeanor, but he's using the weapon, if you, again, believing the government's witness, in a self-defense posture. And so that's why we respectfully suggest intermediate scrutiny.
Not intermediate scrutiny. That's why you think the record needs to be further developed.
Yes.
And we can't do that, so that's why you'd say on that issue it needs to go back for
yes.
factual development.
Yes, Your Honor.
It has nothing to do with intermediate scrutiny. It has to do with development of the record. Correct. Because we can apply intermediate scrutiny ourselves.
Yes, you could, but if it's like Chester, you don't have a sufficient factual record.
That's what I'm saying. It doesn't have to do with the level of scrutiny. It has to do with the development of the necessary facts.
Yes, sir. And Your Honor, it's when I was answering Judge Davis's first comment about how you know, Chester was a CDV misdemeanor in the home. He suggested a CDV misdemeanor.
I heard what he said.
Yes, sir.
Heard your answer to it. That's why I asked you further questions.
Yes, sir.
You might want to move to further argument.
Yes, sir.
Just briefly, if you could, Mr. Sneed, what is the real-world practical effect of this 922 conviction on your client in light of the other conviction? What's the impact on his actual sentence from this conviction?
There's a little bit complicated, Judge, on Reem, because there's a possibility he could go from a level 2 to a level 1 on his criminal history category. And that would be the impact. Because what he has on...
Wait a minute, why would it affect his criminal history category?
The reason I say it is, if you look... I'm sorry, Judge, I know... Okay. If this case were remanded, and he were to challenge the prior CDV conviction, if you look at, there's one body of case law about the burden for the defendant to challenge prior state convictions, the burden's on the defendant.
We're not talking about him challenging the prior conviction. I'm asking you, what is the impact of the conviction in this case on his actual sentence in light of the other convictions that he got in this case?
I think there's a possibility, sir, that it could get his criminal history category reduced if the reason I think would take this to do so, though, Judge.
I don't think you understand. Is that the 922, if what's the impact if that was an acquittal?
Yeah. What if he'd been acquitted on that count?
Yeah. What would the impact be on the sentence and range and that type of thing?
Yeah.
That's the question.
It would remain the same. But perhaps the judge still may have done something different, Judge. And also there's a possibility that he could have got his criminal history category reduced, but I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sneed. Mr. Johnson?
Yes, sir. May it please the court. I know that there are a number of issues before you, and unless you have other questions, I'd like to address them in the order that they were presented by my colleagues, going to Mr. Milling. He talked first about the search warrant. And I think it really comes down to probable cause, even once the incorrect statements are redacted from the affidavit.
Well, we know that. We know what the test is. Tell us why it passes the test in this case. Yes. While the redacted search warrant is valid.
Yes, sir. Because the redacted search warrant sets forth that there was blood inside the vehicle, that there were shell casings, one shell casing in the bed, three shell casings on the ground beside the vehicle, that vehicle had been used to transport...
Are the shell casings in the cabin of the vehicle, or not so, plain view?
Not in plain view.
Okay.
So I think based on those facts alone, the fact that there was a gunshot victim in the car, in the truck, there's blood in the truck, and there's shell casings in and around the truck, that in itself would support probable cause that there was evidence of a crime to be found inside. And so even when you set aside the incorrect statements, I think the probable cause stands on itself. As to the sufficiency of the evidence, you have Justin Bramlett's testimony regarding the truck. Mr. Milling's argument is that evidence was insufficient to show that DiCardio possessed the guns and the drugs that were there. And part of his argument is that...
Let me take you back to the search warrant for a second.
Yes, sir.
And I want to be careful how I phrase this to you, but I'm just going to say it. Wasn't this an adopted case? Was it a state case that was adopted by the federal government for prosecution?
It was.
Is there any cause of concern, maybe even embarrassment on the part of the federal government, that they adopt a case when there is clearly, you can call it what you want, but it is incorrect or false or whatever the word is in that search warrant that began the whole case? Does it cause the federal government any pause whatsoever that you adopt a case like that. And it may not be your choice to adopt it, I understand. But as an officer of the court standing in this case for prosecution in federal court, does it cause you any pause to have to deal with a case that is that factually incorrect?
It does.
Okay. Okay. You can add anything more if you want to. If not, you can move on with the rest of your argument.
Yes, sir. I would like to address that for a moment, if I may.
You can.
It certainly does cause pause, and I think anybody looking at the facts understands that this should have been handled in a much better way by the officers. And our position has been all along that there wasn't any bad faith. It was miscommunication, but
I know that's what your position is, but boy, that's an awful lot of wrong in that search warrant application.
There were many inaccuracies, and it certainly is troubling. But the reason why I believe the federal government went ahead with the case goes back to the probable cause that even if they had not sought a warrant at all, they still would have had probable cause.
But the federal government somehow in some way endorses all those actions up to the point that you actually present that case to the jury, though, don't you think?
Yes, sir. We're bound up in it.
Right.
Their case is our case.
Right.
And certainly we're not proud of the way.
Well, I think I thank you for that, and I think that point's been made. I'll let you make the rest of it.
Yes, sir. We believe the evidence was sufficient to show that DiCardio was in the truck. Mr. Bramlett testified that he was in the truck earlier with the guns. DiCardio was at the hospital. We think the evidence is sufficient on that count and on all the counts. And going to Mr. Sneed's arguments as to the Second Amendment, we do believe that on the facts of this.
I'm sorry. You agree, Mr. Johnson, you agree that the sentence is exactly the same even if he'd been acquitted on that count?
I do agree with that.
Okay. Maybe you don't want to address that.
Okay. Well,
but of course, if Judge Shedd or Judge Gregory want to hear you on that, then.
Well, I'd be glad to answer any other questions that the court has.
What about Bruton? You didn't specifically talk about that, but he raised that. Do you have anything to say about that?
No, sir, except to say that I believe that Bruton and Crawford and Melendez-Diaz deal with different issues. Crawford deals with a more threshold issue of when a statement is testimonial at all, whereas Bruton deals with the issue of when is it testimonial as to a certain defendant. And
so you think the district court did exactly the right thing and how it changed that statement?
Yes, sir, I think he did.
Do you think that, let's go now to Judge Davis's question, do you think that the Second Amendment issue disappears if it has no effect in this case? Think it's mooted out? You understand my question?
I do, Your Honor. I think in any event, it would be harmless error because it doesn't drive the sentence. So I would agree with that, yes, sir.
Well, there are things other than the sentence that may impact, you know, 922 gun conviction. They have some, his incarceration, his placement with Bureau of Prison, eligibility for programs. You did say these are drug cases.
This current case?
Related, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so there may be some implications of drug treatment and those kind of things, and some programs you're barred from in terms of evidence of violence or guns. Many things. Should we just dissipate this error by saying we don't see anything at this point that would change the numbers of days you stay in a prison, but the nature and how you spend those days, I would think, of course, now we're told we shouldn't even consider rehabilitation anymore. We've given up on even that theory.
Yes,
but at some point, does it have some impact, perhaps?
And I don't think so for this reason. You make a good point. However, even if this were set aside, he would still have the
in furtherance conviction
in the 924C. He would still have the drug conviction. So he's a convicted felon either way after this, and he's got the gun count. So if the BOP is basing it, for example, if they're basing his security classification on the fact that you had a gun, then the fact that he not only had a gun but discharged it in furtherance of a drug crime is probably what's going to drive his security classification with the BOP, even if you throw out the 922G9.
In fact, why wasn't there a merger here? I mean, mean, I understand it's okay under Blockberger, I guess, but why didn't the 922 count merge into the 924C count?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Can we go back to Bruton for a second?
Yes, sir.
You didn't mean to suggest, did you, to Judge, in response to Judge Shedd's question, that the court was free not to redact that statement?
No, I did not mean to suggest that.
So it clearly is testimonial as to...
Oh, correct.
Okay. And so the question is, what? The question is whether using the term the driver and the other person, I mean, that was pretty strong implication or inference, depending on how you want to look at it, that was the brother, right?
Yes, sir, when you look at all the evidence in the case.
Well, even looking at the statement by itself. No, not in the statement by itself.
I don't think so, because just looking at the statement by itself, apart from the rest of the context, I don't think you would have any reason to think this was his brother or this was any particular individual.
Okay, so you have to go outside. Your point is you have to go outside the statement to have any idea who the driver was.
I think so, yes.
And by going outside the statement, that takes it out of the facial incrimination point of Gray.
And I agree with that, and I think that's what...
Well, that's a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, yes.
I didn't intend it as an assertion.
I'm sorry. The answer then is yes. And I think that's what this court's cases in Vaught and Akincoy say, is that when you replace it with a neutral word like client, person, individual, then it cures any...
What about the
any,
fact there are only two defendants on trial, and in fact they're brothers? Does that change it? I mean, my goodness. The evidence that he was the driver is just overwhelming, isn't it?
In context, I think, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
And does it matter that there are only two defendants on trial as opposed to three or four defendants on trial? Or three or four brothers?
I mean, I think it's a closer call, but I think it's not a necessary inference that one would have to draw from the document itself. Because, you know, without knowing any of the other evidence, it could have been Bramlett that drove him to the hospital. It could have been any number of people. And I think based on the precedent that we have, this kind of redaction cures any Bruton problem. Unless there's other questions, we'd be happy to rest on our brief, Your Honors.
Are you familiar with the Mayfield case?
I was not until I saw the Rule 28J letter that he submitted.
So you would be prepared to address that in terms of distinction, the case issue in that?
No, sir, except to say that it appears to be in conflict with the cases that this court has decided, particularly Vaught and Akincoy.
Right. It's just very difficult. I mean, I think Judge Davis' questions were questions, not statements, but
sure.
The universe is so narrow here in terms of the driver, in terms of who could it be, and their consanguinity here, which makes it unique, and also not to mention the fact that the circumstances that Frank v. Delaware issue in terms of this warrant ab initio. Why is it that we find it necessary almost to bend over backwards to find ways to convict? Let's redact this. Let's do this. And when you come here to appellate court, we sort of supposed to endorse that. It sort of turns itself on its head a little bit, doesn't it? I mean, just changing, making that neutral, taking his name out, was that really a difference?
I think it was, and if I could answer your question this way, when the parties were discussing this issue with the court prior to the introduction of the statement, one of the questions that Judge Anderson asked is, well, can we get by without putting the statement in at all and just have the officer testify that he talked to Derek, and Derek just says he was the passenger in the truck? And the assistant U.S. attorney said, we're fine with that, Your Honor. However, the statement was also exculpatory to a certain extent because it said we were shot at first. We didn't do anything. We didn't fire our guns. And so one of the defense attorneys wanted it in for that reason, because
really?
It was exculpatory to a certain extent.
So DiCardio's lawyer wanted it in.
DiCardio's lawyer did not want it in.
I'm sorry.
Derek's attorney wanted it in because was admitting being there anyway.
Right.
And it was exculpatory in that he said, we didn't shoot, they shot at us.
That puts tension on the Bruton issue, doesn't it? Because I see exactly that. There are other people who want to say, yeah, I want that. Redaction is fine because my person wasn't in the driver's seat. And then the driver said, no, I don't want that because I'm the only person that could have been there. That really puts in tension Bruton, doesn't it?
It does, but I would say that the tension is very slight because you're not talking about a statement. Often, as is the case in Bruton, you've got two guys who are on trial for common crimes, and they're pointing fingers at one another. And we don't want to admit one statement when there's not an opportunity to cross-examine.
Right.
In this case, Derek is not pointing any fingers at DiCardio. There's just an inference that DiCardio was in the truck with him. And
therefore, he was in constructive possession of the guns and the drugs in the truck.
Correct. When you take the other evidence, but you're several inferences removed from a statement that on its face says that DiCardio committed X crime. That's not what we have here. It's a very inferential. And the whole point of Bruton was we don't want to have inferences that are so strong that even when we give a jury admonition, the jury's not going to be able to put it out of their mind. I don't think we have that case here.
And that's the first time you mentioned that, but that's very critical to your case, isn't it?
I think so.
The instruction that, if I recall correctly, came immediately after, or did it come immediately after or later?
Your Honor.
I guess it came later.
To be perfectly honest, I know that there was an instruction given. Off the top of my head, I do not recall whether it was immediately after or if it was part of the broader jury instructions. But there was an instruction that you can only consider the statement as against Derek and not against the other defendant at trial.
And more importantly, you can only against him. No inference can be drawn against anyone else. Like, as opposed to who the driver would be.
Yeah, I don't think that the government could rely on the statement and say, take DiCardio's statement, this is evidence, or take Derek's statement, this is evidence against DiCardio. I think the point is that.
No, it's part of deductive reasoning. This is evidence that he was not driving.
Correct.
Therefore, in the way this case was presented, who else could have been driving?
And I agree. When you look at all the evidence, it points to DiCardio as the driver, and I can't say that the jury could have put all of that out of their mind when they're reading this statement. However, I think the inferences are attenuated. It's not a statement that is facially incriminatory as to DiCardio, and based on this Fourth Circuit's precedent, you can replace the defendant's name with those kinds of neutral pronouns or other words. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Milling, you back up.
Just to respond very briefly to the confrontation with Bruton issue. When we're looking at Crawford, Bruton, and Melendez-Diaz, they all are talking about the same thing, just different parts of the Confrontation Clause analysis. The focus on Bruton has been whether or not his testimony as against this particular defendant in a joint trial, whereas Crawford and Melendez-Diaz generally talk more in terms of whether or not his testimony at all. But it's interesting in the Melendez-Diaz case, the reason that I cited it in the brief is because the first argument that the government raised in Melendez-Diaz was that it was not testimonial as against this defendant. The subject statement in Melendez-Diaz was a lab report simply identifying that the substance was being tested was, in fact, narcotic.
So your point is why?
The point is, essentially, Your Honor, that Melendez-Diaz authorizes courts to look at other evidence introduced in the case essentially a building block analysis to determine whether or not this is incriminating as against this particular defendant, which is exactly what the Mayfield court does. The Marsh case talks about evidence which was introduced after the patiently non-incriminating statement came in. In fact, Marsh, they redacted any reference to anybody else being in the vehicle. Gray, they took out the name incriminating the defendant in place, deleted, and that's what was submitted to the jury. The Vaught case and the Akinkoya case, which are the two cases from this court, Akinkoya, as I recall, did not specifically address as to whether or not there was any other evidence in the record which implicated the defendant, the non-testifying defendant. But in fact, some of the argument in that case or some of the opinion in that case talks about the pronoun, I believe there was gender differing pronouns, such that it was clear that one of the defendants who was complaining of the Bruton situation with that statement clearly was not implicated by that reference because it was talking about a man when the defendant was a woman. In the Vaught case, it's a situation where the court does make reference in passing that there was other evidence which clearly implicated the defendant, but Vaught, the person who gave the statement was an international lawyer who was giving a statement saying that I went up to Canada to look into a birth certificate for a client. He's obviously going to have a lot of clients, so it's going to be a broad brush situation.
Could you address very briefly the mention about your Derek's counsel wanted it in, and you didn't want it in?
I absolutely did not want it in, and I didn't think that Bruton could clean it up at all.
And how did that play out in front of Judge Anderson?
Well, it was, as I recall, a situation essentially where the government offered one alternative. My alternative was to keep it out in its entirety.
When you say in its entirety, you don't mean the oral testimony about it, or maybe you do.
Well, I had originally taken the position, Your Honor, to keep everything about that statement out because of the implications adverse to DiCardio. I think that there are circumstances under which it could have potentially been cleaned up, but clearly the way that it was cleaned up here
was insufficient. But I mean, Derek's admission that he was brought to the hospital in that vehicle, you have no basis to object to that.
No, sir.
And did you?
As
a part of your keep everything about the statement out?
I didn't.
Were you trying to convince Judge Anderson to not even to admit that?
I believe prior to my having an opportunity to respond to the government's suggestion that we'll offer this as an alternative, Derek Glisson's counsel said that's not acceptable to us, and it was clear that Judge Anderson wasn't going to proceed in that manner. So I don't know that I even had an opportunity to respond to that based upon Derek.
Did you move for a severance at that point? After Judge Anderson made it clear he was going to admit the redacted statement?
We were already into the trial when Judge Anderson made that ruling.
This didn't even come up pre-trial.
We raised it pre-trial, but Judge Anderson reserved ruling until after a lot of the testimony had already been introduced. And that's why I see that I'm out of time, but that's why I think it's so important that Judge Anderson was clearly in a position where he could have looked at the evidence which had already been introduced up to that point in time and determined, as Your Honors clearly pointed out, that this was incriminating to DiCardio. Thank you, Your Honors.
But you didn't ask for a severance mid-trial.
I did not at that point in time, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mr. Sneed?
Your Honors, if I will quickly respond on the Second Amendment issue. I understand the court's concern is, you know, constitutional avoidance. Even if we decide this way, would it affect the sentence? I respectfully suggest that it could for the following reasons. Is if we're presuming that Judge Anderson would do the same thing, but were this remanded and the Second Amendment, the 922G conviction thrown out, he's now facing only three convictions, not four. How can we say that would not influence the judge's sentence? Excuse me. The second reason is there's a way, and I'm not going to mislead the court, but there's a way to attempt to get his criminal history category lessened from a 2-1. And so I don't think this would be, were you to remand Second Amendment issue, to have no effect. I think it could have an effect. I can't promise you that.
Did you attack his criminal history already in the sentencing? On that, what will we do here that could any way impact his prior criminal history?
The reason is this, Judge, is under 18 U.S.C. 21, I hope I'm saying this correctly.
Why don't you just say it?
The government, under 922G, the government has a burden of proof on the prior CDV, the government has to prove that there was either right to counsel, there's a knowing and intelligent waiver right
to counsel. Have you already attacked it on that basis below?
No. And I... Was it not,
was it not ripe to be attacked on that basis?
It was the, it was challenged in the sense that when his criminal history was reviewed,
right,
that was raised, and the court believed determined he did, the defendant did not carry his burden because the defendant has a burden to challenge his prior convictions. But if you look at a 922G, the government has a burden to prove the CDV.
But didn't the government have that before?
Yes, sir.
He was sentenced on the 922G before. I'm just trying to figure out what's changed, what would possibly change between now and the original sentencing as to the prior criminal history. That's all I'm asking you. Something changes?
I would take some persuasion of Judge Anderson that the government failed under 922G to meet its burden that he has the requisite prior CDV conviction.
But you didn't raise that point before.
Yes, correct. It was not, Your Honor. It was not.
Okay.
Oh, but so, in other words, you're representing to the court that there's something else you might be able to raise in that regard.
Absolutely.
And since we're going to send it back and it's been non-conviction, then you get a second trial because you can.
Yes, sir. And I see I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. I note that Mr. Milling, Mr. Sneed, your court appointed. Thank you very much for your services. It's very important to the court, and we appreciate you ably representing your client. And obviously, Mr. Johnson as well, we thank you for representing the United States government. We're going to ask the clerk to dismiss the court.